The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome back to the deep dive. Today, we're stepping away from, well, the usual noise. We're heading to Tinker Creek.
Ah, yes. We are digging into Annie Dillard's really incredible 1974 book, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek.
And it's so much more than just nature writing, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's this deep philosophical, almost spiritual journal. But it's all grounded in this 1 year she spent observing this specific place in Virginia's Blue Ridge Mountains.
So our mission today is really to unpack her central idea, right? About how really looking, or maybe seeing the world around us, changes everything.
Exactly. How that intense, sustained observation of just your immediate surroundings can fundamentally shift how you perceive, well, existence itself.
Which feels incredibly relevant now. I mean, if you feel constantly bombarded with information, totally overwhelmed.
Or like you need some huge exotic trip to find meaning.
Yeah, Dillard offers something completely different.
She really does. She wrote this in the 70s, but it speaks directly to our, you know, modern numbness. She challenges us to develop what she calls radical attention.
Radical attention, I like that.
And the goal of it is that transcendence, those big moments of insight, they aren't hiding somewhere far away.
They're right here.
Right here, in the ordinary. The weeds in the pavement, the way light hits a wall. She argues the real journey is inward, and it demands this sometimes difficult focus on what's right in front of you.
Okay, so let's talk about Annie Dillard herself. Born 1945, she won the Pulitzer for general nonfiction for Pilgrim in 1975.
Yeah, and she was incredibly young, only 29. But beyond the award, what's key is her background, studying and teaching English right there in Virginia, near the creek itself.
So she was immersed in that world.
Completely. And what makes her perspective so unique, I think, is how she blends things. She's like a naturalist, a poet, and a theologian all rolled into one.
She's not just describing plants and animals.
No way. She's doing rigorous observation, almost like a scientist kind of, you know, cataloging insects, thinking about evolution. But she's doing it with this deep, persistent questioning about the divine, about the creator behind it all.
Looking for God in the details, kind of.
Exactly, but not in a simple way. She forces the scientific facts and the spiritual yearning into the same space. She holds the empirical, the hard data, right alongside the transcendent mystery.
And she doesn't shy away from the conflict between them.
That's the engine of the book, that tension. Which brings us to her main argument, really.
Which is?
That deep understanding, real insight, doesn't come from abstract ideas. It comes from looking closely, patiently at the tangible world.
But it requires a certain kind of seeing.
Yes. Yeah. She calls it seeing versus just looking. It requires this radical openness to wonder and, crucially, a willingness to face all of it, the beauty and the horror.
Which gets us to the core problem she wrestles with, theodicy.
Right. Fancy word, but a simple, huge question. If there's a creator, a powerful force behind everything.
Why is there so much violence, so much cruelty, and apparent waste baked into the system?
Exactly. Think predators, parasites, the sheer number of seeds that never sprout. Dillard doesn't pretend to have the answer.
She just lives with the question.
She inhabits it. The whole book is structured like a year-long meditation on this. It follows the seasons at Tinker Creek, spring, summer, fall, winter, back to spring.
So it's a journey outward into the ecosystem.
The floods, the muskrats, the praying mantises.
But also inward, into her own mind, trying to make sense of it all.
Yeah. And who's it for?
Yeah.
Really, anyone asking those big questions about why things are the way they are.
Okay, let's get into some specifics. Chapter 2, Seeing, feels absolutely central.
Oh, definitely. This is where she really lays out the difference between passively looking, which is, let's be honest, what most of us do most of the time.
Uh-huh. We see tree, car, desk, and move on.
Right. Our brain filters constantly. We slap labels on things based on expectation and language, and that stops us from really seeing. Dillard says we have to consciously try to unlearn those filters.
That sounds hard. Like, really hard. Trying to look at my coffee mug without thinking mug.
It's incredibly difficult. She uses this powerful example of people born blind who gain sight later in life.
Oh, I remember reading about that. It's not like they suddenly see perfectly.
Not at all. They're initially overwhelmed by just chaos, colors, shapes, light, all jumbled up because they haven't built those mental filters yet. They have to learn to see painstakingly.
So Dillard wants us to kind of recapture some of that raw, unfiltered perception?
Exactly, to break through our assumptions.
Yeah.
And she describes her own moment of doing that, the famous image of the tree with lights in it.
where an ordinary tree suddenly seemed luminous.
Luminous, yeah. Filled with significance. It wasn't supernatural. It was a moment of intense, unfiltered perception, a breakthrough achieved through attention.
So seeing isn't just passive reception. It's an active skill we have to cultivate.
That's her point. It takes deliberate, maybe even painful effort.
But you can't just focus on the beautiful moments, the luminous trees. Dillard forces you to look at the dark side too, right? That comes through in chapters like 6, The Present, and 10, Fecundity.
Yes. She talks about the discipline of living fully in the actual present. But the present, as she discovers, is often brutal.
This is where the giant water bug comes in.
Oh, the water bug. Yeah. It's maybe the most famous or infamous scene. She witnesses this giant water bug basically liquefy the insides of a frog and suck it dry, leaving just the empty skin.
Ah.
It's visceral. And it shatters any lingering romantic ideas about gentle Mother Nature. It's raw, impersonal violence. Nature just doing its thing.
But couldn't someone argue she's focusing too much on that one shocking moment? I mean, there's beauty, too.
Well, that's the thing. Her intellectual honesty demands she look at the whole system. If you're going to think about a creator, that creator is responsible for the water bug just as much as the beautiful flower or the sunset.
Okay, that makes sense. It's about facing the totality.
And that leads her into chapter 10, Fecundity. This idea of just overwhelming abundance. Nature producing billions upon billions of spores, eggs, seeds.
Most of which just die. They never make it.
Exactly. It seems incredibly wasteful. It's this system of mind-boggling mass production followed by mass death. She wonders, what kind of creator designs this?
It's not a neat, tidy, efficient system.
Not at all. She concludes the creator must have a taste for sheer extravagance, maybe even a sense of the grotesque. It's wild, experimental.
Which ties into another theme, right? Things being hidden.
Yes, like in chapter 3, Winter. Things look dead, empty, but underneath there's all this hidden life preparation happening.
And in chapter 8, Intricacy, she talks about microscopic details, like the tiny barbs on a feather.
Details that seem to have no purpose, no audience. Who are they for?
Which leads her to this idea of a hidden god. Deus absconditus.
Yeah, literally a god who hides. A creator who lavishes attention on these incredible, intricate details that maybe no human will ever see or appreciate. Creating for creation's own sake, maybe.
So, faced with all this, the beauty, the horror, the waste, the hidden detail, how does she navigate it? How does she live in that tension?
She develops practices, spiritual disciplines, really. In chapter 11, Stalking, she describes trying to empty herself, become receptive.
Like becoming invisible?
Sort of. Becoming a dull, receptive spiritual blob, as she puts it. The goal isn't to catch the creature or analyze the moment, but just to be there with it, fully present, without ego.
Just receiving whatever reality offers.
Right. And then she balances that intense focus on the immediate with chapter 14, Northing.
The monarch butterflies.
Yeah, that incredible, mysterious instinct that drives monarchs and other creatures on these massive migrations, thousands of miles towards something, an unseen goal.
So amidst all the apparent chaos and violence up close,
there's also this hint of a larger, underlying, maybe inscrutable purpose or order operating on a grand scale.
And the journey is circular. She ends where she began, at the creek, the change.
Absolutely. The pilgrimage transforms the pilgrim's vision.
Okay, wow. That's a lot to process. So if we had to boil it down, what are maybe three key takeaways we can actually use?
First, definitely the art of seeing versus merely looking. The big idea here is that real perception means actively unlearning our filters. We have to consciously strip away our expectations to see what's actually there.
So in everyday life, maybe walk into a room you're always in, like your kitchen, and try to spot one detail you've genuinely never noticed before. The way the light hits something, a pattern in the floor.
Exactly. Interrupt the autopilot. Force yourself to look fresh. It's a practice.
Okay, number two.
The paradox of creation. We have to learn to accept that beauty and horror, creation and destruction, aren't opposites. They're two sides of the same coin. They exist together, always.
That feels important for just dealing with life, really. Accepting that things and people can be complex, wonderful, and flawed at the same time.
It builds resilience, emotional honesty. You don't need everything to be simple or purely good. You accept the contradictions because that's how reality is, like the water bug and the butterfly coexisting.
Right. And the third takeaway.
The sanctity of the present moment. Really being present for whatever's happening right now, even if it's difficult or shocking, like that water bug scene. The goal isn't to judge it or fix it, but just to witness it.
That feels like a powerful antidote to anxiety. You know, so much of anxiety is regretting the past or worrying about the future.
Precisely. If you can practice just observing something simple, clouds moving, leaves rustling without commentary, you anchor yourself in the now. It interrupts that internal chatter.
And Dillard's writing itself is just stunning, the way she phrases things.
Oh, absolutely. Some lines just stick with you.
Like when she talks about becoming aware, I had been my whole life a bell and never knew it until at that moment I was lifted and struck.
Isn't that beautiful? It suggests consciousness is this potential for resonance, just waiting. And attention, that's the striking that makes it ring. Seeing isn't just passive, it's like grace activated by effort.
And her description of the creator, definitely not some gentle, boring figure.
No. She says, the creator is no Puritan. A creator who could create such a monster as a giant water bug must have a sense of the grotesque, and the creator must have a taste for sheer extravagance.
It's such a bold, almost wild way to think about it. Embracing the weirdness, the excess.
It's incredibly freeing intellectually. The universe isn't neat. It's wildly experimental, overflowing.
And then that final crucial line about our role. Beauty and grace are performed whether or not we will or sense them. The least we can do is try to be there.
And that gives me chills. The universe is putting on this constant show. Our job, our unique capacity as conscious beings, is to pay attention. To witness.
Attention as a moral act, almost.
I think so. It gives meaning to the performance.
Okay, so bringing this down to earth, how do we actually do this in our crazy lives? I like your idea of a Dillard walk.
Yeah, just pick one spot, your backyard, a park bench, even the view from your window, and commit to observing it regularly, maybe across different seasons or times of day.
Without headphones, without distractions.
Right. Just look. It builds that concentration muscle. And that focus, that improved attention, it spills over into everything else, work, relationships.
And mentally, maybe the biggest shift is just embracing ambiguity.
I think that's huge. Learning to hold complex, even contradictory ideas in tension without needing to immediately resolve them or pick a side.
Like in a work disagreement or understanding someone complex.
Exactly. Remember the water bug and the butterfly. Reality holds both. Dillard teaches us to live in that paradox, not try to smooth it over.
And finally, just cultivating that sense of wonder, maybe. Questioning things.
Definitely. Dillard shows that deep questioning is a spiritual path. You don't need dogma, you just need curiosity about how things work, why things are the way they are, and an openness to mystery.
So what was your biggest personal takeaway from revisiting this?
For me, it's always the reminder that transcendence isn't somewhere else. You don't need the pilgrimage to Mecca or Machu Picchu, necessarily. It's available right now, wherever you are, if you cultivate the attention. She heals that artificial split between science, rational observation, and spirituality, that sense of awe and mystery. They belong together.
Yeah, I agree. For me, what always hits hardest is her absolute refusal to sentimentalize nature. The horror is just as important as the beauty for understanding the whole picture. It makes me realize how much the quality of my own life really does depend on the quality of my attention. Am I just sleepwalking, or am I trying to be there?
And ultimately, she doesn't give you easy answers. That's the point.
Right. It's not a self-help book with 5 steps to enlightenment.
No. It's an invitation to a different way of being. The real takeaway is living more fully inside the questions, embracing the tension. The pilgrim's journey never really ends.
A challenging but ultimately rewarding perspective. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.